You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, September 17th. I'm Julia Cash from Drake University. Here is our first story. Hispanic Heritage Month Underway by Mike Brownlee. Central Latino of Iowa and Council Bluffs kicked off Hispanic Heritage Month and celebrated its expansion of space and services during an event on Wednesday. We are very thankful to have been here for almost 20 years, Central Latino Executive Director Ramon Calzada told a crowd of about 50 people who gathered for a ribbon cutting to celebrate the center's expansion and take part in an open house. Calzada explained the Central Latino, located in the Omni Centre, offers a variety of programs with a focus on four key areas: community outreach and advocacy, leadership training, Latino entrepreneurship, and cultural competency and integration. The center has doubled its space, adding on open space for hosting a variety of classes, including English and navigating differences classes, while also adding a child care area to help fill a need in the community. The center is almost expanding its workforce focus. Centro Latino has partnered with AmeriCorps on projects. Centro Latino opened in 2002. Calzada told the crowd when the Latino population in the area was around 2%. It was at 11% by 2010. And Calzada said he's awaiting full 2020 numbers for the area. The state Hispanic or Latino population grew to 6.8% from 5% in 2010. We want to show the growth in the Latino community. We're still growing, Central Latino Executive Director Ramon Calzada said. We have a new influx. Our focus is on how do we help get them integrated. We also offer our Navigating Difference course as we try to educate others as well. Meet in the middle. The center also recently put together a strategic plan that sharpened its focus on the four key areas as the organization looks to grow its reach in the step with the growth of the Latino community. Central Latino Board President Vanessa Doubles said, "We want to be sure we're providing opportunities for folks to thrive in this community in a self-sufficient, independent, and strong way. Today is the first step in that direction, to have a collaborative space." Doubles said in order to accomplish the center's strategic directions are empowering the community, expanding the center's mission, and engaging its partners. This is a collaborative effort that provides an opportunity to engage the community further. Doubles said, "We want people to feel welcome. You can provide all the services you want, but if you don't have anyone asking to receive them, it doesn't matter." Central Latino will host its annual Iowa Latino Festival from noon to 5 p.m. on September 25th at Bayless Park in Council Bluffs. The event will feature a variety of Latino culture activities, including musical performances and dances, along with fun for kids and a variety of booths from area companies, nonprofits, and government entities. Learn more at sucentrallatino.com. Story is Mandate Polarizes Parents, Students by Tim Johnson. Tuesday's meeting of the Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education took a turn during a discussion about masks as anti-mask attendees began yelling at board members. Beginning Wednesday, September 15th, all Council Bluffs Community School District students, staff, and visitors will be expected to wear masks at school during school hours when physical distancing is not possible to help control the spread of coronavirus. According to a message from Superintendent Vicki Murillo sent to staff and parents Tuesday morning, the move came after a federal judge blocked enforcement of Iowa's ban on school mask mandates Monday. Board President Chris LaFerla told the crowd that the district was a defendant in the federal case in which a judge blocked enforcement of the Iowa law that bars school districts from mandating the use of masks. After this ruling, we are faced with very real legal liability if we do not use masks, he said. Why is there no legal liability if they get sick with something else? asked Brian Haney, who spoke during the public participation portion of the meeting. Haney noted that suicide, abuse, and drug abuse have all increased substantially during the pandemic. "We're putting our entire population at risk by mandating these things," he said. "Are you prepared to face lawsuits from the other side?" asked Adam Duvall. That drew a loud round of applause from many in the boardroom. "This is a temporary restraining order," Amy Foster said. "The law still stands. You are choosing to muzzle our children. You're forcing children to be responsible for other people's health and safety." One father said he had heard students who refused to wear masks would be taken to the office and their parents called to pick them up. "I'll be pulling up to the office and taking my child out for ice cream," he said. That also drew applause. Melissa Tucker also spoke during public participation. "I hear you are legally bound to mask our children," she said. Tucker said young boys, like her son, hear different frequencies than girls, and that he has trouble hearing his teacher when she is speaking through a mask. "How are they supposed to learn?" she asked. "If you read on the packages, these masks are not going to prevent COVID-19, Tucker said. "Is there any way everyone can be educated?" Patrick Mendozo said he bought several packages of masks and he still has the papers that says they won't work. "This is nothing but a sham," he said. "In the beginning, this was about the virus. Now it's about control. I am not going to force this on my son. I'm not going to make him wear a mask, and you're not going to make him wear one either." Fran Parr, another parent, said she thought the board was doing a good job in the untenable situation. She suggested parents with objections contact Sam Longhold, an assistant in the Iowa Attorney General's office who is involved in the case, and air their grievances. A teacher who is also a mother with a child cystic fibrosis was in tears as she tried to speak at the podium. "It's hard to hear he doesn't have the right to be safe at school," she said. "As a kindergartner, he does wear his mask. My third grade class last year, they rallied around me at the end of the year because they knew she did not want to take the virus home to her child. Think about others," she said. Marsha Cook said her son had sores last year from his mask. She said there is bacteria in the mask. "Other schools are not mandating masks," she said. "I understand there's kids with issues that need to wear masks. My son shouldn't have to when he doesn't have those issues." Others in the room began yelling, saying, "You guys have failed your schools already." At about this point in the meeting, LaFerla called a recess. "Are you guys really prepared for all those lawsuits?" one man said. "Show me the science that shows masks work." "It ain't going to save you. You guys are stirring up a fight, and I'm going to fight. We can vote these people out today," he told the crowd. He asked for a second and third, then a hand vote. They failed everybody. The crowd could not, in fact, vote out the board at the meeting. As more people began yelling, the board members quietly left the room, followed by school employees. A police officer entered and stood at the side of the seats watching. Then two more entered, then another. The meeting attendees slowly moved out into the corridor where they continued their discussion. The anti-mask sentiment showed up again Wednesday in a small walkout at Abraham Lincoln High School. About 8 students went out at one time or another between 12:15 and 12:45 p.m. 2 students' mothers also went to the school and joined the students. Eventually, Reuben Cano, chief of high schools, came out. One mom asked whether students would be forced to wear masks. He said they would not be, nor would they be sent home if they refused to wear one. A couple students said their teachers had yelled at them for not wearing a mask. Another student said she had not worn one all day, and none of her teachers had said anything. The mother thanked Cano for answering her questions. "I know you guys are in a difficult position," she said. "I know you're trying to do what you think is best." The moms left shortly after that, and the students went back to class. The court case began when 11 parents in the ARC of Iowa, a group that defends the civil rights of people with disabilities, sued the state and a handful of school districts on September 3rd. On Monday, a federal judge put a temporary restraining order on enforcement of the law that bans mask mandates, effective immediately. Judge Robert Pratt said in an order Monday that the law substantially increases the risk of several children with health conditions of contracting COVID-19, according to the Associated Press. Because plaintiffs have shown that Iowa Code Section 280.31's ban on mask mandates in schools substantially increases their risk of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19, and that due to their various medical conditions, they are at an increased risk of severe illness or death. Plaintiffs have demonstrated that an irreparable harm exists, he wrote. Pratt's order said Government Kim Reynolds and Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Lebo cannot enforce the new law banning local school districts from using their discretion to mandate masks for students, staff, teachers, and visitors. He said that almost 40 years earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that, regardless of citizenship status, denying school-age children a free public education violates the U.S. Constitution. The next story is District Receives Offer on Madison Campus by Tim Johnson. The Council Bluffs Community School District has received an offer on the Madison Campus property. Officials announced during a hearing on the property's possible sale held Tuesday by the Board of Education. The board plans to vote on whether to accept the offer during its September 28th meeting. The Madison Campus building, formerly a Target store, was purchased by the school district for $1.9 million in 2018 to use as a temporary school facility during the renovation of Kern and Wilson Middle Schools, and a $4.4 million remodel of the facility was paid for with funds from a $37 million bond issue approved by voters on September 11, 2018. Kern students attended classes at the Madison campus during the 2019 through 2020 school year, and Wilson students had school there during the 2020 through 2021 school year. The 95,355 square foot property is currently listed by Heartland Properties at $3.9 million. John Jerkovich, a partner of Heartland, said the Menards project planned for the site of the former Mall of the Bluffs has been delayed drastically. When the new Menards store is built, it will likely bring lots of traffic, including truck and semi-traffic. That might limit the number of other potential buyers and might not make it a good place for a school, Jerkovich said. I think you're going to see a very busy site out there, he said. I really see the building getting a different type of use. Jerkovich said the prospective buyer was a company that would put it on the tax rolls and create jobs. He declined to reveal the offer or the identity of the business. The company has been in Omaha since 1979, said Jason James, his partner at Heartland Properties. It currently employs about 500 people and sells products throughout the lower 48 states. If it acquires the Madison campus property, it would hire about 68 employees for the Council Bluffs location, eventually expanding to up to 100. The jobs would offer compensation of $60,000 or more, with the average salary between $70,000 and $75,000, he said. James said they had showed the prospective buyer properties in Omaha, but they were not interested in them. We're not really moving forward anymore until we see how this comes out, he said. Options that have been discussed, if the district keeps the property, include using it to house Canesville Alternative Learning Center, the Educational Service Center, meeting and training space, and/or the district's Operations Center and Warehouse, said Corey Vorthman, Chief Academic Officer for the district. Repurposing the building would require some renovation, which would be an expense, along with maintenance and utilities, he said. If the district sold the property, it could not pay off the general obligation bonds issued for the middle school and Madison campus projects until 2027, but could put the proceeds in a fund and draw interest, said Dean Wilson, Chief Financial Officer. If the district sold the property and continued to rent space in the Omni Centra Business Park for the Educational Service Center, it could save about $5.2 million by 2030, Wilson estimated. Among other things, it would save the district having to pay for installation of a new roof and resurfacing of the parking lot in the next 5 to 8 years, he said. It would also free up the property to be put back on the tax rolls and used by a business and would create jobs. However, it would mean the district would have no place to serve as a temporary school if it decided to renovate the old Washington Elementary School building, which currently houses the Canesville Learning Center, or if another building were damaged in a storm or other disaster, he said. Dozens of residents attended the hearing. During public participation, the first woman to speak said the district had led voters to believe they would keep the Madison campus building after the middle school renovations were finished. "We will remember what you told us," she said. John Metz, the next speaker, said he thought it would be better if the property were used by someone else. "I think we can sell that and pay off some of our debt," he said. "You need to run the school like a business, not a handout." Jack Hamilton said he had read in the public notices how much the district is paying to rent space at the Omni, about $20,800 per month, and was hoping it would move its offices to the Madison campus. "If you take that $20,000 a month for 10 years, we could do a lot with that," he said. "You could lay a lot of pavement for $20,000 a month." Hamilton said the district could avoid an expense remodel by removing a few walls and putting in cubicles, like those in the ESC. He said he hadn't thought about traffic, but didn't think ESC staff would have any trouble. Heidi Petro felt strongly that Canesville Learning Center should be moved to the Madison campus. "You have alternative learning center students in a building that is full of asbestos, and that's why you move the elementary kids out of it," she said. "It's not your building, it's our building. We pay every 6 months on our property taxes. It's time you started realizing this is not for a buck, but for our children," Petro said. "Children are not for sale." That prompted cheers and applause from the other attendees. Brittany Heman, a substitute teacher, spoke next. "When I go and visit all the different buildings, I had the privilege to sub at Canesville," she said. "There's holes in the wall, there's cracks in the floor. These kids deserve better." She also got applause. Many of the Canesville students are going through tough times at home and working outside of school, Heman said. "Yet they are staying in school and trying to make a better life. And the Washington building, unlike others in the district, is not secure," she said. "You have staff members there that feel abandoned," she said. "You have students that feel neglected." Brian Haney said if it saves the district money, they should sell the Madison campus. "Average spending per student has gone up exponentially over the last 20 years," he said. "That building was fine for us growing up. It's good enough for them." "That's just disgusting," the next speaker said. "Do you not have kids?" She said she had worked in the preschool children's square USA used to have in the basement of the Washington building, and it had been flooded and had mold growing there. "I graduated from Canesville, and that building, the school, was then in the Tinley building, was just disgusting, she said. We tore that down, but we're keeping this one and keeping our kids in it. Our kids are our future, she said. That prompted a hearty round of applause and completed the hearing on the potential Madison campus sale. Our next story is Iowa Learning More About Opioid Money by Rod Beauchart. Des Moines, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said Monday he wants financial proceeds from settlements with opioid manufacturers and distributors named in multi-state lawsuits to be directed toward treatment, recovery, and abatement efforts to address addictions that claimed at least 213 lives in Iowa last year. My goal has been to use this additional money in the best possible way to deal with this enormous crisis epidemic that has harmed so many people and was totally unnecessary, Miller said in an interview. Miller was actively involved in several settlements reached in recent months, including a $26 billion agreement with three major opioid distributors, Cardinal McKesson and Mary Source Bergen, and Johnson & Johnson, which manufactured and marketed opioids, and a $4.3 billion settlement with the Sackler family and their company, Purdue Pharma, that will generate money to help bring relief to people across the country struggling with opioid addiction. While there are still areas of the complex agreements to be finalized, the Iowa Attorney General said he believes things are progressing to a stage where Iowa will begin receiving $15 to $20 million initially sometime in 2022 as part of a multi-year effort to abate an opioid crisis the defendant drug companies helped create in Iowa and across the nation with false and deceptive claims and marketing. There's still a lot of things to be done, but it's hopefully crossing the Rubicon, he said. To that end, Miller said his office has been working with officials in the State Department of Public Health, counties, the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, and others to begin shaping a strategy to identify the addictions Iowans are dealing with and tailor ways to treat complex features of the opioid crisis, while recognizing that the lawsuit proceeds won't come close to meeting the needs of Iowans trying to overcome addictions to prescription drugs, heroin, or fentanyl. One of the things we should do with the money is just find out as best we can the degree and the source and the type of addictions in Iowa. That's something that I would advocate, he said. Miller noted that the settlement agreements provide that the proceeds have to be used for abatement purposes. Initially, he said, a national administrator will sign off on the settlement money and make sure the plan used by Iowa officials fits within the intended uses. We want to make sure that the benefits from the additional money are spread out throughout the state, that everybody in the state has a chance to benefit from this. The Attorney General said, we hope that this can be a model for dealing with an addiction. Opioid-related deaths increased by 35% in Iowa in 2020, following a national trend that has advocates raising the alarm about the surge. State officials reported 213 opioid-related deaths last year, up from the 157 deaths reported in 2019 and a previous high of 206 in 2017. Miller said his office is negotiating with state public health officials and Iowa county attorneys on how to proceed with the settlement money. Discussions also have taken place with UIHC officials to use up to $3.5 million for training using telemedicine for doctors, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants that focuses on federally approved medication-assisted treatment and concentrating on complex cases. We believe that there are a number of people who could quit completely through treatment, and that's the optimum. That's what we want, Miller said. But we think there are many others who can't, and we think the medication-assisted treatment is a very viable alternative, and we're going to work towards that. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, September 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Julie Cash from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. The next story is Only Murders in the Building, A Good Time with Old Comedy Friends. Steve Martin and Martin Short are comedy royalty, comedy icons, since co-starring in one of my guilty pleasures, Three Amigos, 1986, I can even sing along with My Little Buttercup. Their acting paths have crossed several times, including the Father of the Bride movies, and more recently, in their 2018 Netflix special, Steve Martin and Martin Short, An Evening You Will Forget for the Rest of Your Life. The actors slash comedians slash writers have exceptional rapport, so it was probably only nature for them to decide to join forces again for Hulu's TV series Only Murders in the Building. In this mystery slash comedy endeavor, Martin and Short are joined by singer slash actress Selena Gomez. Martin plays Charles Haddon Savage, a silver-haired actor known mostly for his one role as a TV sleuth in the 1980s. Short plays Oliver Putnam, a mostly failing theater producer who is on the verge of being evicted. And Gomez plays Mabel Mora, a woman from the wrong side of the tracks who is squatting in their upscale New York apartment building, the fictional Anconia. All come together when a rather unlikable tenant, Tim Kono, is, you guessed it, murdered during a fire drill. While trying to figure out who committed the murder and why, the two celebrity has-beens collaborate on a podcast based on their investigation. It's a way to jumpstart their careers, and Putnam hopes it will raise much-needed funds. Murder mystery podcasts are incredibly popular, after all. The series premiered August 31st, and I'll be honest, initially I was skeptical. I saw the press photo slash poster and wondered what two septuagenarians were doing running around with an almost 30-year-old. If it was a love story, I would give it a hard pass. No one needs another project about old men and young love interest. No one. But I do like both Martin and Short, so I watched the trailer. It seemed promising. Hulu was smart in that they released the first three episodes for immediate screening. For the rest, you must wait for a new episode to drop on Tuesdays. I watched them one after another and got immediately hooked. It's a very entertaining series. The writing is sharp and funny, and Martin and Short are a joy to watch, playing so naturally off one another. Martin is the reserved straight guy. He always kind of over it. And Short is the flamboyant, effusive, always trying to get an ill-conceived project off the ground type. Their personalities couldn't be more different, and watching them react to one another is never dull. In fact, it's so enjoyable watching them that Gomez doesn't really need to be here. She gets cast regularly as an actress, and I don't get her appeal. As a singer, she's very good. As an actress, yeah, no. No doubt she was brought in to bring in younger viewers, thus giving the show broader appeal. If you are older than 40, you will enjoy the celebrity cameos, including, so far, Sting, Nathan Lane, Amy Ryan, and Tina Fey. Our next story is Lynx Swimming Wins DM North Triangular by Austin Hinnan. The Council Bluffs swim team, powered by the Des Moines North Polar Bears and the Des Moines Hoover Huskies in the North Triangular swim meet on Tuesday. With a team score of 104 points, CB shredded the competition by placing first in 8 of the 11 events. Seeing this much success was more than pleasing for Coach Logan Maxwell. "We had a fantastic meet with a lot of improvement in the water," Maxwell said. "We had personal bests in many of the entries, moved some girls around, and stepped up when we needed to." North doesn't have the greatest facility we see throughout the year, and I challenged the girls to work through the old blocks, slick walls, and rough water. They did just that, and credit to our captains Aurora Miller, Elania Vorochitsky, and Jocelyn Miller for getting us there and focused. "I'm proud of the progress we've made, and we are well ahead of where we have been in previous years at this point." Junior Claire Crilly won the gold in the 200-yard freestyle with a time of 2:16:33. Junior Jocelyn Miller placed first in the 200-yard IM with a time of 2:39:17. Junior Elena Brachotiki took first in the 50-yard freestyle with a time of 26.52 seconds. Brachotiki also won the 100-yard freestyle. Sophomore Cameron Moon won the 500-yard freestyle for the Lynx with a time of 6:25:62. Senior Lillian Lefebvre won the 100-yard backstroke with a time of 1:13:12. Along with all the individual success, the Lynx 200-yard freestyle relay team earned first place as well with a team time of 1:51:25. Members of that team include Claire Crilly, Aurora Miller, Jocelyn Miller, and Elena Vorochitsky. These four girls, also a part of the 400-yard relay team, that won first place as well with a time of 4:16:49. "These girls have brought into believing together to prove that we are here to stay," Maxwell said. "That mission is critical to keep at the center of what we do at every practice and meet, whether we swim Sioux City, Doling, North, or anyone else. These girls bring it every time, and tonight it showed, winning 8 of 11 events. The Lynx will remember to the water on September 21st in a duel against Sioux City West at Kern Middle School starting at 5:30 p.m. Our next story is Ike Hearn Second at Valley by Peter Huguenin. Titans compete at Valley Invite in West Des Moines. Lewis Central sophomore Ethan Eichhorn continued his dominant season on September 14th at the 47th Ton Carpin Cross Country Invite in West Des Moines. After winning his home invite on Saturday, Eichhorn took second on Tuesday with a time of 16 minutes and 48 seconds. Lewis Central head coach Taylor May said he was proud of how Eichhorn and the rest of the Titans ran. "I thought it was a good night," he said. "Coming up here to Valley is always a tough meet. There's some really, really good competition here in Central Iowa. It was a good day to run, and I thought the kids ran well and responded and took into account the competition and really pushed themselves to be better tonight." Eichhorn won the first high school varsity race of his career on Saturday and is setting high goals for the rest of the season. Marshalltown senior Connor Smith won the race with a 16:35. "Obviously, coming off a win, it's good to be in the top two again," May said. He was second here last year also. He's put himself in a good position to get that win against hopefully sometime soon. Eichhorn's time was 32 seconds faster than last year at the same course. He wasn't the only runner to impress May at the race. Kay Durex had a really good race for us today. He said, coming up here and finishing in the top 25, that's pretty impressive as a sophomore. Cade had a really, really good race. He's had a good last couple races. He's really on the uptrend and really improving. Logan Foley and Marshall Arkfeld ran good for us too. They pushed and tried to bring that backpack up towards the front a little bit. On the girls' side, freshman Maya Humlesick and Myrie Menz led the Titans. Humlesick ran a 22:34. Maya and Myrie leading us again as freshmen is awesome to see, May said. They just keep pushing and bring those older girls along with them. I thought they both had really good races today, and Isabel McNeil had another good race for us today. We're continuing to improve. Our girls are on the uptrend, and we hope they can continue to work toward that. Lewis Central is in action next at 4 p.m. on Tuesday at the Crichton Prep Invite. Our next story is Claude Bell Tie for First in Duel by Peter Huguenin. Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson boys golf squared off on Tuesday at Dodge Riverside Golf Course, 2 weeks before the Council Bluffs City meet. It was a close match decided by less than four strokes, but the Lynx edged out the Jackets 227 to 231. Abraham Lincoln senior Brody Klopp and Thomas Jefferson freshman Kendall Bell tied for first, with both golfers shooting a 54. It was a really close match. I think both teams are pretty evenly matched, AL head coach Rob Dittmer said. It was good in the sense that we were missing two of our varsity guys. I thought some of the other guys filled in nicely. Brody Klopp had a really good day. That was his best score of the year so far for nine holes. Klopp wasn't the only standout for AL. Jameson Vandeville has filled into our number one spot, and he played well. Mason Garions had a really nice day. He shot a 60, which was pretty good for him, I thought. Thomas Jefferson head coach Matt Connor said he was also happy with how his team performed. I think we're trending in the right direction, he said. We're starting to see some of the things we're working on in practice coming through when we're playing our meets. We just have to put it together more often. That's the only thing it is. You have to be able to do it consistently, and we're working to get it there. I was happy with the guys' results. We had some good shots and some bad shots, but mentally we put them behind us and kept playing. I thought it was pretty good. Connor added he was especially excited about the play of Bell. It's very positive watching him play, Connor said about Bell. He's making his way around the golf course, which is great. Every time we've played here, he's gotten one or two or three strokes better each time. That's great to see. It's his first year playing golf. You can just see the confidence and the knowledge coming through each round he plays. Our next story is Lewis Central versus Norwalk. The word, Lewis Central football may have one of the toughest schedules in the state to start the season. That won't change on Friday when Lewis Central travels to Class 4A, number one, Indianola. Indianola junior quarterback Bennett Bruck has thrown for 770 yards and 8 touchdowns on 44 completions, and senior running back Kale Kolorick has rushed for 318 yards and 6 touchdowns on 52 carries. They're a very balanced football team offensively, LC head coach Justin Kamrad said. They pass the ball really well. They run the ball fairly effectively and have a really good running back. They do a lot of really good things on the offensive side. They're probably the most complete team we've seen thus. Cumrod added the key to slowing down Berwick. We'll be playing in position and now allowing easy throws and easy completions. Junior receiver Drew Kingery has 318 yards and 5 touchdowns on 16 catches. The Indians' defense has also been stout, holding opponents to under 15 points a game in the first 2 weeks. Pella did find some success in week 3, scoring 37 points. Defensively, they give you some fits, Cumrod said. They get after the football and are very aggressive and fly around. Obviously, you don't go 3-0 by not being very good, and they've done a great job of getting their guys in position and playing well. That won't be an easy task as Southwest Valley senior quarterback Brendan Knapp has rushed for 426 yards and 7 touchdowns on 55 carries. They do a really nice job of doing what they do, Driver said. They run the ball, they play defense, and they're fundamentally sound. They're fairly decently sized up front. They have a really nice quarterback that runs the ball and throws the ball well. We just have to hopefully maintain position and align right and do our responsibilities, and good things hopefully will happen. Driver said the team will specifically have to find a way to shut down Knapp, who also passed for 71 yards. He's their best playmaker, kind of like us with Brendan being our best playmaker, Driver said. He runs the ball, he throws the ball. There are design quarterback sweeps. He does a really nice job of reading the option, things like that. To combat this, Driver said the Falcons will need to align correctly and tackle better. Defensively, the Timberwolves have been running a 4-4 with a fairly standard defense that features man-to-man and cover 3 schemes. They're really fundamentally sound, Driver said. Their ends do a nice job of containing the quarterback and getting pressure. They do a really nice job of disrupting things with their penetration. Their linebackers do a nice job of filling the holes. Driver added that a key to the game may come on the O-line, where the Falcons are starting some younger players that had their first taste of varsity last week after some injuries forced some substations. It's always tough to go down to corning and playing, Driver said. It's a long road trip. We're a little more used to being in the Hawkeye 10 now with our travel. It's always a ruckus environment if you've never been there. That's a little different for some of our kids. I don't think they've been down there. A lot of them haven't been. It's a fun place to play. Thomas Jefferson versus Kroll. Records. Thomas Jefferson 0-3. Dennison Schlegswig 1-2. Last week, Thomas Jefferson lost to Kroll 24-14. Dennison Schlegswig lost to Creston 35-14. Win 7 p.m. Friday at Wickersham Stadium. Rankings. Neither team is ranked. Thomas Jefferson will be looking for its first victory of the season at home against Dennison Schlegswig. Dennison has always been a team that plays really physical, head coach Brandt Anderson said. It's no different this year. They always have some pretty athletic skill players. Dennison has 2 backs over 100 yards and senior Matthew Welts and junior Jackson Hildebrand. And the Monarchs have rushed for 9 touchdowns as a team. They have a big running back that runs pretty hard, Anderson said. They mix around. They do a few things with some misdirection. They're kind of a wing T type of offense. Sophomore quarterback Luke Wibbers has passed for 561 yards and 2 scores, but has also thrown 4 interceptions. Offenses have found some success against Denison, scoring almost 30 points a game. The Monarchs have lost games to Abraham Lincoln and Creston. AL does some things similar to what we do, as does Creston, Anderson said. Last two games, their opponents have done things similar to what we try to do from an offensive standpoint. We studied both of the teams and looked at the way they attacked and the ways they had success. Our next story is Ram Volleyball Sweeps Tourney by Peter Hugenin. Class 4A number 7 Glenwood Volleyball stretched its win streak to 5 on Tuesday in a triangular at Atlantic, sweeping both Atlantic and Clarinda. The Rams are now 15-2 on the season. Glenwood defeated Clarinda 25-13, 25-19, 25-12, and swept Atlantic 25-16, 25-12, and 25-20. Senior Lauren Ronfeld led the Rams in assists with 53. Senior Briley Arnold finished with 19 kills. Senior Kennedy Jones blocked 4 shots at the net. Freshman Charlie Hernandez and senior Coral Matheny each tallied 31 digs, and Hernandez served 6 aces. Glenwood is in action next at 7:15 p.m. tonight at home against Shenandoah. Our next story is Saints Top Panthers by Peter Hugenin. St. Albert Volleyball swept Creston in Tuesday night's home match using effective serving to keep the Panthers on their heels. The Saints swept the Panthers in 3 sets, 25-21, 25-8, and 25-19. Creston always plays us tough and is always aggressive, head coach Angie Lentz said. We did some good things on the night and have some things we will continue to work on. St. Albert served 9 aces as a team and had a serve efficiency of 94.6% compared to just 76.1 for Creston. Senior Maddie Horvath led St. Albert in assists with 11, and sophomore Ella Klusman dished out 8 assists. Senior Lauren Williams paced the Saints with 8 kills, and senior Allison Narmi and Mia Alman both drove down 5. Narmi also blocked 4 shots, and Williams finished with 12 digs. Junior Laundry Miller totaled 11 digs. Klusman served 5 of the team's 9 aces. The victory improves St. Albert's record to 5-6. The Saints are now 7-2 against the Panthers since 2013 and have won the last 2 matches. St. Albert is in action next at 7:15 p.m. tonight at Kemper Catholic. Our next story is SAXC wins AHSTW meet by Peter Hugenin. St. Albert boys cross country ran away with a victory at the AHSTW invite on Tuesday in Avoca, with 3 runners finishing in the top 10 of the meet and 6 in the top 20. Junior Colin Lilly won the race with a time of 17 minutes and 17 seconds, defeating Underwood senior Bryce Patton by 27 seconds. The St. Albert girls also had a good race, finishing in 2nd place behind Logan Magnolia. Freshman Tyler Tingley led the girls with a time of 21:41 and a 3rd-place finish. St. Albert girls are running very well, head coach Russ Sindeller said. Carly McKeever ran a great race along Tingley. Brenna Smith ran a much improved race as Kennedy Sanchez, and Mallory Dolly. These girls are racing well and displayed that. The boys' team is consistently getting better and continuing to run personal best times on all courses. They are very hungry to win. Colin had another individual victory, and Hayden Biskorski ran a greatly improved race. We had a newcomer to the boys' team, Mandelo Dang, at 7 feet 1 inch. He is easy to spot. He ran a great race on his inaugural outgoing. Our boys' team is truly a tough team. St. Albert is in action next at 9 a.m. on September 25th at the Harlan Invite. Some obituaries. Linda Kennedy Wood. Linda Kennedy Wood, age 75, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 14, 2021, at her daughter's home in Harlan, Iowa. Linda was born April 4, 1946, in Omaha, Nebraska, to the late Joseph and Blanche Newland Kennedy. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1964. On July 21, 1967, Linda married Jerry Jake Wood in Omaha. Linda worked at Frito-Lay for 15 years, retiring in 2001. In addition to her parents, Linda was preceded in death by her husband, Jake Wood, in 2017. Sisters Elaine Kennedy and Karen Rocha, brother Gary Kennedy. Linda is survived by her daughter, Melanie Christopher Carpenter of Harlan, son Brent Tracy Wood of Red Oak, Iowa. Grandchildren, Jessica Quentin DeMonette, Trevor Wood, Matthew Michaela Wood, Allison Downing, and Colton Downing. Great-grandchildren, Maggie Wood, Hudson Olson, Finley Wood, Baby DeMonette, brother Denise Kathy Kennedy of Council Bluffs, many nieces, nephews, and in-laws. Visitation with the family Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill, Mayor Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Saturday, 1 p.m. at the funeral home. The family will direct memorials. Our next story is Starting Young Students Are Right in Astronomy by Bob Allen. A good friend of mine has a young daughter who has developed an apparent fascination with the stars. That is a good thing. Some of the questions, however, have stumped him. That isn't a good thing. I explained to the father that astronomy is a learning experience, and the best thing he could do to satisfy his daughter's inquisitive mind was to take her to the public library. As I've mentioned in many of my columns in the past, there are a multitude of beginner's books and other materials at the library that are written and designed especially for the young of age, as well as the sometimes overwhelmed parent. By combining through the astronomy shelf, you should be able to By coming through the astronomy shelf, you should be able to find topics that interest the child and then follow it up in further books. As Alan MacRoberts wrote in Sky and Telescope magazine, many newcomers to stargazing blunder down the wrong trail that too often leaves them lost and frustrated. It's too bad that there isn't a way to post a couple of well-chosen direction signs at the beginning of that trail. In addition to the books, another way to stimulate a child's learning experience in stargazing is to take them to the Count Zay Planetarium on the campus of University of Nebraska at Omaha. To find out which programs are being offered at the planetarium, call them at 402-554-3722. I think parents will enjoy the experience as much as the child. Astronomy is an outdoor nature hobby. Living in the metropolitan area with its abundant skylight, we are limited as to the number of stars visible to us. I would suggest a trip outside the city lights to give a new stargazer the chance to view the constellations they have been told about, read about, or seen in pictures. When the father brought up the subject of telescopes, I explained to him that too many times parents spend a lot of money for a telescope only to have the child lose interest when it does not perform the way they expect it to. Very young children are unable to understand cause and effect or to rationalize what it is you're trying to explain to them. That is especially true with a telescope. I told the father that he should explain to his daughter that the hobby of astronomy can be a source of enjoyment her entire life. I also mentioned that the most successful stargazers are often the ones who began with the least equipment. What they lacked in gear, they had to make up for by study, sky knowledge, and maps. By fine-tuning their observing eyes first, those skills will come in very handy when the gear does come. A good portion of stargazing activities will be disrupted by the moonlight as the moon approaches its full phase Monday. We should all get prepared for the beginning of autumn in the Midwest at 2:21 p.m. on Wednesday. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, September 17th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Our volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Julie Cash from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.